Welcome to Radio 5G with Michael Henry Dunn, Nancy Hopkins, and friends, a Cosmic Reality Radio production.
When all the broken-hearted people living in the world agree, there will be an answer, let it be. For though they may be parted, there is still a chance that they will see. There will be an answer, let it be. Or let it be.
And we are live.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Radio 5G. This is Michael Henry Dunn, and this is Wednesday, April 17th. Very glad to be with everybody today and with my co-host, Nancy Hopkins of Cosmic Reality. Say hello, Nancy.
Hi, everybody. I hope you're having a good day. I hope we have a good show.
Oh, yeah. Lord knows there's plenty to talk about today. We are focusing on several different things that are so big all at the same time. Obviously, the fire at Notre Dame is very much in, well, it's certainly in my consciousness, very powerfully today. And how that fire happened and how it plays into the larger picture of what's going on the planet, spiritually, geopolitically, which ties in, believe it or not, back to the rollout of 5G. And what we see happening as we are starting to see some small victories in the effort to prevent the rollout, to at least delay it in some places as the telecom companies are being forced to admit that they have done zero investigation into the health consequences of this lethal technology. So we'll be talking about Notre Dame. We'll be talking about Joan of Arc. We'll probably be talking about the Knights Templar. We'll certainly be talking about the Trump administration's policies around 5G. We'll be talking about victories being racked up to stop 5G in cities like Mill Valley, California, Sebastopol, California, in Brussels, capital of the European Union, in Belgium. Switzerland is starting to oppose the rollout of 5G. I'm speaking to you from New Mexico this afternoon, and I will be meeting later today with some of the activists in this part of the country who are gathering their neighbors, their friends, their communities, finding out what tools are out there. At our website, 5G-KNOW.com, 5G-KNOW.com, we're sharing as many of those networks and tools with all of you as we can. So that's what's up for today. Plenty to talk about. And Nancy, do you have some thoughts you want to start rolling with? You know, we started to look at a lot of different things in the wake of this shocking, mind-blowing event in Paris, which is to me it's a planetary impact because the power of that place and that cathedral from a Templar perspective, from the grids of Gaia, and how ancient Templar science was used to create that cathedral as a holy place that was in alignment with the grids and ley lines. It's an ancient place of the goddess from Isis times in the Roman era. And it's, you know, it was a place of great devotion to the divine feminine, Notre Dame, Our Lady. And for me, as a Templar, and I do still use that name unabashedly, the fire at Notre Dame strikes at the heart of what I have cherished myself in terms of sacred activism, chivalry, and defending sacred knowledge, defending those who cannot defend themselves. Certainly in the very long battle effort campaign to take down the elite pedophilia networks, the code of chivalry is essential to that fight. So anyway, with that little intro, let's get rolling. There's so much rich material to cover. Do you have any thoughts, Nancy?
Well, I just want to try to bring into focus something that we discussed, what we were discussing sort of as we heard about the fire, that we really need to realize that 5G is simply the focal point right now where people are getting really, you know, like aware that, my gosh, this is something terrible that's happening. But that's only the first skirmish. We're going to stop it. We got to stop 5G. Anybody that really looks into it, you find out that, and we'll talk about this in, you know, probably in the, I think in the second half, the 5G question, but it's, when people become aware of it, it's so stupid, they go, what? Okay? But that's only one of the battles. Many of the people that are coming to us for 5G, they think that, okay, we're here only for 5G. Well, no, we're here because 5G is a focal point for waking you up. When you follow the 5G rabbit down the hole, you're going to find out that most of your reality was not what you thought it was. You're going to get a taste of that, I think, when Michael begins to explain to you the full depth of history, because we are isolated. And the young people, they don't even know a lot of history, A, because they don't get taught it anymore, and B, a lot of us were told the wrong history. So when we go off on these, what seemingly are tangents from 5G, no, it's the backdrop to how did we get to 5G? Now, we don't have to worry about that in the initial skirmish because we're just going to shut it down. But it's not the end of the battle. It's only the first bit. It's the first skirmish. And we want you to be aware that, you know, some of the things we tell you are going to stretch your credibility. But if you've already had your credibility stretched to the point of bonkers because you're saying, what do you mean they're putting in a weapons system? And they're calling it 5G. And they're telling me that I can have all of this wonderful telecommunications. Why do I need it? I've already got great communications. What's the purpose here? And I do want to point out something else, that let's assume that we did need more speed, more communications. There's a thing called fiber optics. If you put in fiber optics using basically, I mean, fiber optics is going to give you more speed than you can even handle. It's a tremendous amount of money to redo the system into fiber optics. But they're going to put $20 trillion into 5G that has all of this stuff hanging from poles that winds can come and knock them down, and there's maintenance and everything. Why would they go with something that technologically doesn't make any sense? And we're trying to, when we get off on these tangents like we're about to do with Notre Dame, we're trying to give you the backstory of why they would want to do something that seems insane to you. I just wanted to kind of point that out, Michael.
Yeah, I hear you. It's... when we are talking to people about 5G these days, we're focusing on mainstream stuff because not everybody wants to go down the rabbit hole. And if we are trying to focus community groups, civic action, political action, for example, on takebackyourpower.net, the notice of liability tool they're using to let legislators and city council people know that they will be personally liable for the diseases and tumors and deaths and miscarriage that results from the implementation of 5G. You know, we're letting people know these are mainstream issues. You're the value of your house is going to go down. Your mortgage could be underwater. Your children could be neurologically impaired. I just heard a horror story from a local Taos activist that they heard the information. You may know this already, Nancy, and this might have been from Mark Steele, our friend in the UK, that in Bristol, which is not that far from Gateshead, where Mark is, since 5G has rolled out, I mean, 36 teen suicides in the mere months since it's been rolled out in Bristol. And because, of course, teens are the most vulnerable, it's pretty intense. Not to get sidetracked into that, but we try to touch mainstream issues for people because we want to get the support. Hey, this is going to hurt your health. It's going to hurt your kids. It's taking down the biosphere and it's going to put your mortgage underwater. Let's go to work and stop this. Most people can hear that part. And as you say, once they open that door, though, they're looking at the looming rabbit hole at their feet. And today, in this show, we're going down that rabbit hole. And there's some fascinating history down that rabbit hole, especially when you come to Notre Dame. And so it ties into the Templars. It ties into why they were taken down. It ties into who are the successors today to the factions that took down the Templars, that massacred the Cathars, that instituted the Spanish Inquisition, which persecuted earth-centered spirituality and feminine wisdom for centuries. Millions of women were burned at the stake during the reign of the Inquisition, which lasted for centuries, but it began with taking down the Cathars and the Templars. That's where the long fall into the darkest time from which we're emerging, but that's when it really began. So, I mean, there's the question of how the fire started. There is the indication right now that it's a mystery. Some footage has emerged online of a UFO being sighted over the cathedral just before the fire began. There is talk of directed energy weapons, such as the firemen in California. Never seen anything like those fires and the way in which those fires were instigated. There's been I heard the figure of 800 vandalization attacks on Catholic churches in France over the last few months. Whether that was designed to be a distraction, like it's, some anti-Christian cult or something, and then they top it off with destroying one of the most powerful ley line sacred geometry, divine feminine temples in the world. That's something for us to explore. Nancy, would you like to jump in here on the how the fire started question?
Not this second. I forgot to turn the... Okay. Well, that's really far down the rabbit hole, and it's all conjecture. But what the heck? the whole thing is getting, everything is getting faster and faster. We try to stay into the, 3D, let's focus on this, but everything is so intricately, meshed together. There's this thing called remote viewing. For those of you that have never heard about it, if you saw the movie, they kill goats, don't they?
It's called Men Who Stare at Goats.
Oh, that's right. That's what it is. Okay.
You're probably thinking if they kill horses, don't they?
Yes.
Jane Fonda back in the 1970s.
Oh my God. That movie. Oh, that was not a good movie. Oh.
Right.
That was, anyway. They shoot horses. Good. We'll get it straight. This is an ability that virtually every human being has. They just don't know how to use it. And it is the ability to use your mind to okay, let's say go someplace else. Or it's not exactly that you go anywhere, but you're bringing the scene to yourself. I don't want to get too complicated, but anyway, it's okay. I'm going to tell it like they would have told it in the movies. Okay, so Michael and I are talking, and we're talking about what we're going to do today, and plans that go bad or plans that change drastically, and all of a sudden we're aware that the church is on fire. So we start talking about that. Now, being a remote viewer means that I can essentially go wherever the situation is and take a look at it. I'm sitting in my chair. And so I said, well, wait a minute, let me look at this thing. So I go to where the fire is and immediately was overcome with the amount of emotion that was there. It was, oh my gosh, such sadness. It wasn't anger, it was frustration and sadness and, just really very bad. And so I said, well, I don't want to be here, so I back out of it. And I said, okay, and I'm talking to these, to Eleni and Michael while I'm doing this. I'm going, okay, I got to get before the fire happens. And because I'd already seen the pictures of the way it was burning, I knew it was towards the back, let's say, where the spire is. So I project into the spire, underneath the spire area, and I end up in a room that was fairly empty. There was some, stuff, like construction stuff thingies, maybe. But to the side, it was basically an empty room and dark. And I'm thinking, okay, now my reason for going there was to get back to where I thought the fire would start, because front part of the building has got people in it, and I'd seen that it had started there, but it was dark. It wasn't pitch black, but it was very, very dark in there, and nobody was around. I didn't hear any sounds. I didn't detect anything. Nobody seemed to be there, and then suddenly there was this explosion above my head, and when I yanked my head up, because you're in a virtual reality is what it is. It's 3D, but in your mind it's like a virtual reality, but you'll react the same way. And I got spooked and I threw my head up, and when I threw my head up, it essentially threw me out of the remote. And so then I went, okay, and then I went back in, but this time I didn't go all the way in. I sort of went to the area to pick up the energy fields and the thoughts and things are there, and I'm going like, what just happened? And then I get this visual picture of a DEW beam. Now, DEW is directed energy weapon, and what they do is they take the system that you got in your 5G, okay, they take that, they build it up a little bit, they focus it down so that they can essentially use energy to destroy anything. Now, in the case, and this was the same thing that was used to take down the towers at 9/11. In that case, the beam was very, very strong and actually caused a disassociation of the molecular structure of the building, so that the cement went to powder and so did all the metal. Because one of the key clues to what was a direct energy weapon was the fact that in 110 stories, two 110 stories, okay, the pile was only 7 stories high. And you'd go, where's the buildings? What happened to them? Well, they never found one door handle, one metal door, one desk that happened to be metal. The filing cabinets, they found one. And the one that they found, they knew was a filing cabinet, not because it looked like one, because it was melted into the size of a basketball, but because inside this molten metal, there was a strip of filing files. You know, the ones that hang were in there. Paper. Because there was paper all over the place, there was plastic all over the place, but there was no metal. The only things that you did see were the big beams, and those were very few and far behind. And those beams, if you remember, they would have already started rusting. What started the rusting? It was because the DEW had set up a resonant frequency that was taking these things apart. That's not what happened in the Spire, even though it's the same technology, because what they did was more like what they did in Paradise, California, and through the California fires. You've got your electric system that's running through, you know, just the wires themselves. In the case of here, they had the smart meters too. So all they had to do was put in a frequency that caused all that stuff to essentially burst into flames. And so that's what happened above me. I would suspect there was probably was construction because they were doing renovation at the time, but something exploded. I mean, it just was like this whoom, you know, and this, it wasn't a big bang. It was more like a bang type of sound. And so when I asked about it, I saw the DEW come in and hit the Spire, and I said, oh. I said, this came from above. It was DEW. And then I think either one of them asked me the question or I asked myself, but it was like, who? And one of you asked, and I said, who? And I said, well, the good guys. Because it didn't feel like there was any, it felt like, I didn't feel the cabal energy, the dark energy. It was like, this, we've got to do this thing. Now, so then I'm going like, you know, well, why did you do this, you know? And then I get what I call downloads. It's like little bursts of video that go through my head. And what it was that when you're dealing in this world of craziness, I'm old enough, I'm 70 years old, I'm old enough to remember when fairy tales and stories were real to children, because they were real, they are real. And so I hold this kind of imaging that, you know, yes, all this stuff that everybody thinks is not real is really real. And I think a lot of us have lost that because of age and because of the way that we've been controlled and manipulated by just everything that we see. But there are magicians. There are individuals who use energy to propel reality. Because reality is what we think it is. That's just a fact of science. Quantum physics is going to tell you that. Metaphysics will tell you that. Enterology will tell you that. So the second rule is that the majority wins, and it's not how many numbers of people, it's how forceful you can put out an energy thought to dominate a reality. So, for instance, a lot of you people that might be listening to me right now, you know, 4 weeks ago, you didn't know what 5G was. You thought it was the next best thing in communications. And now you find out it has nothing to do with communications or telecommunications. It has everything to do about controlling you. I mean, that's jumping into a really, you know, the middle of a sci-fi plot. You know? And now I'm telling you that it goes even darker beyond that. But the beauty of this is the rules. Because the third rule says anybody in charge of a given reality will tell keep everybody else from knowing rules 1 and 2. But we know rules 1 and 2. Reality is what we think it is, and majority rules. So the dark side tries to keep you muddled thinking dark side stuff. And the light side was, to be honest with you, just going about, you know, there's some bad stuff. Maybe we better fix this little thing here and this little thing here. They never got focused on this systemic background of why there is this evil part of our society, of our civilization, that can even imagine building this 5G system. And I know that they built it intentionally, because back in 1976, an insider told me that this is what they intended to do. And for 43 years, I have watched this happen. But what I've also watched is the awakening of humanity and the awareness that, oh, okay, we got to deal with this. because humanity has the capacity to deal with anything that God, nature, or the bad guys throw at us. We're here to grow, to learn, to find out who our authentic selves are. So when I'm telling you these weird stories about remote viewing and seeing DEW and, you know, it was above me, they asked me, what is it? I said, think ET, because I didn't know what had done it. There's a secret space program a lot of you don't know about. It gets very complicated. But the bottom line is it's okay. We're all waking up, and we're working together.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, my overall feeling about this. I mean, I was just struck numb almost with shock when I saw what was happening. And there's a grieving, you know, for me and for millions of others because this was and hopefully will be again, but was a focal point of devotion to the feminine aspect of Source. And it was a place where high sacred science of light and beauty and sound and the energies of the earth and the historical devotion to the divine feminine that has been there for longer, much longer than the cathedral has stood, that this was just indescribable to see this happen. We need to imagine as Americans what we would feel like if, I mean, it was grievous enough, shocking enough, horrible enough, of course, on 9/11 to see the towers fall, to know that 3,000 people died there and in the Pentagon. Well, you know, imagine the additional emotional impact if they destroyed the Statue of Liberty, which, by the way, of course, was a historic gift from the people of France in 1876 on the anniversary of the centennial of the Declaration of Independence. I mean, you just try to imagine, you know, the psychological and emotional blow to the people of France, because Notre Dame is much more so than the Eiffel Tower. The Eiffel Tower, you know, it's only a century or so old, and it's not a sacred symbol. It's whatever it is. It's the Eiffel Tower. Somebody decided to put it up. God knows why. But Notre Dame, you know, it's difficult to put into words what the attack, and I will use the word attack, on the cathedral and the near destruction of it. Apparently they are hopeful of being able to restore it. It's just what that means. Energetically, it's not just about the loss of a beautiful building or, you know, the impossibility of restoring it to what it was. They'll do their best and it will be as close to it as they can make it. But much more so than just the loss of a beautiful building or seen as an attack on the Catholic Church, in terms of the ley lines of the planet, the grids of Gaia, and how both the light and the dark attempt to use that natural energy of Gaia to their advantage. Notre Dame and other places such as Chartres Cathedral or Mont-Saint-Michel or the Great Pyramid of Giza, Stonehenge, other places around the planet are precisely aligned with the grids of Gaia to maximize the spiritual power of those places. So this is not just about a fire at a beautiful church. The Templars built Chartres and they built Notre Dame using the sacred sciences, sacred architecture, sacred geometry that they had learned in Jerusalem in excavating the Temple of Solomon that transformed the architecture, the sacred architecture of Europe. And so this was a focal point of sacred power on the planet and of devotion to the divine feminine. And so whatever was going on there in terms of an attempt to somehow derail that energy, to destroy it, or because this feels like a crucial moment in the struggle for human freedom and the restoration of our planet right now. And for this place, this sacred place, to have suffered this at this particular moment, sorry, the coincidence is way too off the charts. And, you know, I don't want to be glib or pretending to know things I can't know right now about who did it, why they did it, how they did it. But I think we need to just look and see and recognize that this is much more than just an unfortunate fire at a beautiful church. That the history of Notre Dame and how it ties into the whole arc of Western civilization and the sacred science of the grids of Gaia is that's the real story here. And ultimately, it does tie in, believe it or not, to 5G, in that 5G represents pretty much possibly the ultimate attempt to lock down the planet, to lock down human freedom, and to prevent the ascension of the soul by the dark faction. And you need to make the reluctant and unfortunate realization that there is conscious evil on the planet that is well organized. It's not monolithic. They fight each other all the time because guess what? You know, cultures and factions and societies that are centered around serving self, well, they end up fighting each other. No honor among thieves. So don't think that the cabal is this monolithic, all-powerful entity. They're not. But we need to recognize that it exists. I spoke just this morning with a survivor of the elite pedophile rings. And there is no denying this reality that there is, as Nancy says, both the light and the dark attempt to use these subtler energetic realities. And what we're witnessing is a big time final move, series of final moves going on. And I don't know how this plays out, but it's like I think you said, Nancy, it backfires on them every time. They're brilliant dark magicians and they're stupid. They're moronic in their ignorance of divine reality. 9/11 backfired. Their attempt to start a war in Syria backfired. It backfired. And this attack upon Notre Dame is already backfiring massively in terms of the awakening, in terms of the grief and how it is turning to the devotion, and how it is turning to the determination to elevate the divine feminine, to restore the balance, because the patriarchy has wreaked havoc on the planet, the debased masculine, not the sacred masculine, not the exalted masculine that is evident in the life of Christ or of Buddha or of the other great men, saints. But this is this moment when it's already backfiring on them. And to me, and to you too, and I'd love to hear you talk about this, to whom, you know, our relationship to Gaia is personal, it's real, it's not just a scientific concept for the conscious biosphere. No, she's real, she's personal, she has a voice, and her presence can be felt. I mean, to me, you know, God is impersonal and vast and beyond comprehension and the unmanifest absolute, the Godhead and beyond all vibrational reality. Yes, there's that. And God is personal because he's become all human beings. And, you know, we're just asleep about it. But anyway, that's my two cents about reality. So that's where I'd like to see our conversation flow today. It's about as big a picture, as big a perspective as you could put on this fire, but that's what I see happening. And it's already backfiring on them. Would you agree with that, Nancy? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, before we get into that, I really would like you to tell the history of the church. What I put here in our chat, which is in the radio chat, you'll see it. It's the promo for this show. Because you sent me some pictures of Joan of Arc and, you know, and I'd really like you to talk to that. And the other thing that I think is very interesting, I look at life and I see a lot of symbology. There's pictures that freeze in your head. And so when I look at the pictures that were out, I wanted to say to myself, okay, what is going to become the the hallmark picture for this event? And it was the one that is the first one in the series in the promo there. And you'll see that at the top of the dome building, there is a symbol. And so I said to Michael, do you know what that symbol is? And yes, in fact, he did. Because this is a symbol to me that people are carrying in their minds. And they may as well know what that symbol means and how it connects to a very deep history that still, you know, if you don't understand history, you're going to repeat it.
Right, exactly. Well, that is the Cross of Jerusalem, is one name for it. And as you can see it in, if you happen to be looking at the logo poster for today's show, it is one central cross of equal arms. It's not shaped like a crucifix, because the four arms are of equal length, and within each quarter there is an identical cross. So there are five crosses, one in each quarter, and then the central cross. This was the central symbol in terms of the heraldry of the kingdom, the Crusader Christian Kingdom of Jerusalem, which of course is closely linked to the Knights Templar. The Knights Templar were given sovereign patronage and first came into existence as an order of chivalry in the year 1118 AD in Jerusalem, which was then under Christian control. King Baldwin II was the sovereign who gave the order its patronage. An order of chivalry, a legitimate order of chivalry under customary international law, has to be given sovereign patronage by a head of state, a monarch, or a figure on the order of the Pope, for example, a head of a church. Which isn't to say that a chivalric movement can't say, well, that's all very lovely, we're not strictly within your rules of sovereign patronage, etc. Spirit has its own motives and movements. But anyway, that's how it began. So that symbol predates Christianity. It is not specifically, as you can see, a typical Christian crucifix. It has a deeper meaning. It later, because of its association with the Kingdom of Jerusalem and the Templars, became a secondary Templar symbol. There is the well-known red cross pate, as it's called, which is actually a sacred geometry symbol. That Templar cross, which was later appropriated by everybody from Mexican drug gangs to Adolf Hitler, that symbol is actually deeply embedded in the mathematical structure of the cosmos. So again, it predates Christianity. It is not specifically a Christian symbol, but it is a very powerful, sacred, geometrical symbol. Both the typical Templar cross pate and the Cross of Jerusalem have that powerful, sacred, geometrical, deeper meaning. And so there are so many elements at Notre Dame that were Templar inspired, that were Templar guided, particularly the devotion to Saint Mary Magdalene. As you can see on the poster there, we've shared with you, Nancy has shared with you, there is an image of Mary Magdalene on the facade of the cathedral, and she is crowned. This is a saint wearing a crown, which is pretty unusual. If she is a queen wearing a crown, well, who is her king? Well, that can be only one being. And she is wearing a small money pouch, which is girded in a rope around her shoulder. It's at her hip. And that is a symbol of the Magdalene, because the gospel says she provided for the Lord out of her purse, the Lord and his disciples out of her purse. So she was not a prostitute. Mary Magdalene was, in fact, from what you might call Jewish aristocracy. And so that became a symbol of the Magdalene. So here you have a woman who was a queen, who was also providing for the Lord out of her purse, and is definitely not the fallen woman prostitute that a later pope just sort of conflated her image into the fallen woman. And there's a long story there. And all those who have studied the truth about Mary Magdalene are well aware. So then you'll see on that same poster we've shared with you a statue of Joan of Arc. Now, Joan of Arc came a century after the Templars were taken down. The Templars were taken down on October 13th, 1307, by the French King Philip IV, because he owed them a great deal of money. They were a rival power base in his realm. And he had been trying for a number of years to take down the Templars. He was threatened with excommunication by the Pope for trying to take down the Templars. And so that Pope got mysteriously murdered, and historians pretty much agree that Philip was behind murdering that Pope and replacing him with a pliable Pope who would go along with taking down the Templars. So here we have Joan of Arc. It's a century later, in the 1400s, and the Templars were, many of them were arrested, tortured, made to falsely confess to a laundry list of heinous crimes, spitting on the cross, bestiality, you know, worship of heathen idols, etc. you know, put you on the rack for a few hours, tear your fingernails off, and start to burn your feet, and one is liable to confess to the usual list. They later, many of them, recanted. Now, here's where Notre Dame comes in. The head of the Templar Order, Jacques de Molay, the last Grand Master of the Templar Order, was arrested, along with many other Templars. He was tortured for a number of years, ultimately confessed to the same laundry list of crimes. And he and two other leading Templars were brought out in front of the cathedral of Notre Dame, several years after the takedown of the Templars. They were brought out in public to confess to their crimes, so the order would be permanently disgraced, and they would then be sentenced to life imprisonment. And King Philip was counting on this as his final nail in the coffin of the reputation of the Templars, who were in fact the carriers of devotion to the divine feminine through the dark times. That was their true purpose. So Philip was counting on this, but what he got instead was that when Jacques de Molay was supposed to stand up and confess, what he did was he stood up and repudiated the confession, said the confessions were false, that the Templar order was pure, and that the only betrayal that they had committed was not a betrayal of Christ, but a betrayal of their brother knights by seeking merely to survive by making these false confessions. And so Philip was absolutely outraged that his PR plan went awry, And he ordered them to be slowly burned at the stake on the spot. Actually, it's just a few hundred feet away from the front of the cathedral, and the Ile de Juifs is where the three of them were very slowly burned that later that same day. And they were offered opportunities to confess. We will put out the flames. You can still live. And they refused. And so that legend went deep into the hearts of the people. Their ashes were collected as martyrs. They had upheld the truth about the purity of the Templar order. And so whatever you hear about the Templars being Illuminati, they're part of the dark faction, you know, they are the actually dark ruling elite. That is the usual disinformation, defamation, smear campaign that the dark factions do to every institution of nobility or spiritual enlightenment or uplift that you will find. The Catholic Church, or the Franciscans, or the Jesuits, or the Jewish faith, or the Freemasons, or the Templars, they have all been subject to systematic defamation campaigns so that every inspiring group or truth that is out there, we will cease to believe in because, oh, they're tainted, oh, they're pedophiles, oh, they're just part of this dark faction. Just think about it, folks. Within the heart of those organizations and movements is the yearning of the human spirit to reach towards God, towards Source. So anyway, that's part of the history of Notre Dame too. And if you want to get into its more ancient history, and feel free to break in, you know, any time here, Nancy, because I'm going to be going on at some length. I mean, it's a fascinating story. But you may have, you know, questions and things to bring in. So the cathedral is a successor building to many previous churches that stood on the spot. Originally in Roman times, there was a temple to Jupiter. And then the first church was dedicated to Saint Stephen, constructed in the late 4th century, that was then rebuilt in the 7th century. There were several larger churches. There was a Basilica of Saint-Étienne, forgive my poor French pronunciation. And so it was in the year 1160 that the Bishop of Paris, Maurice de Sully, decided to build the new and much larger church. And he demolished the former Romanesque cathedral and chose to recycle some of its materials. So that was during the heyday of the Templars. And of course the church, was not fully completed. Just want to make sure of my dates. I think, 1240, it took nearly a century to build. And, you know, it suffered terrible damage before. It was in such terrible shape at the end of the 1700s that after the revolution, it was desecrated during the revolution, that it was nearly torn down. But Napoleon decided, as a symbol of France, he wanted to be crowned emperor inside Notre Dame. And so he was. This brings us back to Joan of Arc. The statue of Joan that is in Notre Dame, she is wearing a Magdalene money pouch. That is a Templar hint. That is a Templar symbol linking Joan of Arc to Mary Magdalene, who was the patron, the patroness, the protectress of the Templar order. If you look closely at the sword she's wearing, that is not an accurate, historically accurate sword from the 1400s. It is accurate as a Templar era sword. This is another indication, a link to Joan as a hidden Templar. Before the siege of Orléans was lifted, when Joan, at the age of 17, this peasant girl out of nowhere with nothing but passionate conviction and the guidance of God, was given command of the armies of France, and she was going to lift the siege of Orléans,
Can we just stop here just for a second and give a little background to what was happening at that time? Why was she there?
Okay. She was there. And this, you know, this all comes down to sovereignty, Nancy. The sovereignty of the soul and the sovereignty of the nation state. And France was almost done at that time when Joan, France was on the point of becoming an English province. This is the Hundred Years' War, and this is towards the end of the Hundred Years' War, and the French had suffered a series of defeats. Agincourt with Henry V defeating the French, massacring the French army was the worst of them. The treaty that followed basically signed over the succession to the French throne to the English. King Henry VI, a little boy, the son of Henry V, was crowned King of France. This is an English king, was crowned King of France in Notre Dame, inside the cathedral. And the Dauphin, the French heir to the throne, was all he had was a tiny little bit of territory left. The armies were dispirited, his treasury was depleted, and he didn't even believe in his own legitimacy as the son of the king. He actually doubted whether he was the true heir to the throne. He was getting ready to throw his crown into the river and flee to Scotland, pretty much leaving France to permanently become a province of England. So the whole contribution of France as a nation state to humanity, to civilization, the, you know, incredibly precious cultural contribution of France over the succeeding five centuries would not have happened in the same way at all if it were not for this peasant girl who shows up out of nowhere and says, God has commanded me to liberate France from the English. So the English had been laying siege to Orléans, and it was a key strategic point militarily, and the city of Orléans was on the brink of being starved out. And if the English could control that strategic point with the river and to the remaining part of France that was still French, bye-bye, curtains over. France is done. And so in the course of maybe 11 weeks, that Hundred Years' War ended because of a 17-year-old girl and because of the heart and inspiration and fire that she lit in the people of France and in the soldiers because of who she was. So she shows up at the head of this army that's come to lift the siege, and she says, my voices, meaning St. Catherine, the Archangel Michael, St. Margaret, who had been speaking to her for some years, have directed me to ask for a sword. There is a sword at the church of St. Catherine de Fierbois, buried just behind the altar, below a few inches of dirt. And please go to this church and ask the priest to dig up this sword. You will know it because it has five crosses on it. And I am to carry this sword into battle. So if you look at the fire and you look at that symbol above the burning spire, that is a cross of Jerusalem. It's the five crosses of the cross of Jerusalem. And that is the sword carrying that symbol that Joan of Arc carried into battle and lifted the siege of Orléans in a series of furious assaults in which she led the assaults. She didn't strike a blow. She just said, vive la France, and here we go. So, you know, I've been a devotee of St. Joan of Arc since I was 8 years old, as you can probably tell. But how this, you know, this all ties back into what we see happening. Globalism, the extinguishing of the sovereignty of the nation state by the eradication of national cultures, national sovereignty, that is a long-term agenda of the dark faction. And the divine, we may assume, didn't want that to happen to the nation of France. It had too important a contribution to make. So that is why that happened. Another piece of evidence is the banner of Joan of Arc. And sadly, along with the desecration of Notre Dame, her banner, her actual banner, the armor she wore, her sword, was preserved in the city of Orléans up until 1789-1790, and the revolution took care of that. It disappeared in the fires and chaos of the revolution. But that banner had an image of God the Father enthroned, and it said Jesu e Maria on it, Jesus and Mary. Now, it's very unusual, speaking as a Catholic, to see the name of Jesus paired with the Blessed Mother. And as a Templar, my thought is that this was, in fact, a oblique reference to Mary Magdalene. That was a typical thing that the Templars did. They used the cover of devotion to the Blessed Mother as a way of referring to Mary Magdalene. In the Templar code, the Temple rule that was first put forward at the beginning of the Templar order, they specifically say the strength of, they usually translate it as saying, the Spirit of God works strongly with us. But if you go back to the original Old French, that's not what they said. They said, the Spirit of our Dame Dieu works strongly with us. Well, what is Dame Dieu? That is Our Lady God. That's a pretty explicit reference to the divine union of Christ and the Magdalene. And so that, you know, Notre Dame, Our Lady, it carries both of those streams of devotion to the Blessed Mother Mary and to Mary Magdalene. So I'm going to pause here because I've been talking for a long time. I mean, this is intensely interesting to me, as you can probably tell. But we, you know, I'd love to have you come in with whatever thoughts you've got rolling here about all this, Nancy, as we're sharing this.
Actually, I also find this whole history thing, you know, fascinating. What a little background is that when those of you that might be familiar with Dan Brown's work, The Da Vinci Code, that he wrote as fiction. Well, many of us were trying to get that information out as fact. And I wrote a book concerning it. And when people would get to the point that I said that Mary Magdalene and Jesus Christ were man and wife, a husband and wife, they would absolutely freak out. Until Dan Brown comes out with his fiction. And so even though they want to freak out, they go, oh, but it's only fiction. But it has become a thought that has crept into the subconscious of people. So it doesn't have quite the impact for a lot of people, but for some people it does. And what's, the history tells us that, you know, just like you think she was a prostitute and she wasn't, she was, you know, from a, basically an affluent family. And the concept that, you know, he was celibate. There are actually children by that marriage. And there is a definite line of history that says that the Merovingians that became the kings and queens of France were actually one of the grandparents of the beginners of the Merovingians was of the descent of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. So this concept of Mary Magdalene that we don't see in America or in a lot of our churches is one that in France, particularly because that's where they went. After the crucifixion, they went to France. And when they got to France, she was revered by a large group of people that lived in and around the area called the Cathars. And that's another story. But she was... So she's a very real character historically in France. So I'm going to stop here, and I'm going to put a little tune on, and then we'll come back for more history, hey? You good with that?
I'm good with that.
Okay. We'll be right back.
Breaking free. up in the ocean of revolution. Every ripple felt by the younger generation. Just rise and take your stand where you belong, cause it's awakening, replacing them false religion. Truth has spread like wildfire in the streets. Anything less than equal rights get deleted, cause all your consciousness we are seek. Open up your heart and let that inner voice speak. Hey. Capitalism and them economy. It's up to we, so open up your heart and let love lead the way.
And we are back.
All right. Well, we were deep into the history of Notre Dame and the history of France and the history of the Templar, the Knights Templars, and talking specifically about St. Mary Magdalene and the idea that there was a sacred union between Jesus Christ and St. Mary Magdalene. Now, because I was deeply involved for some years with an attempt to lineally restore the original Templar order, this is a subject I'm pretty familiar with. And I would like to say, just in response to what you were saying, Nancy, about Dan Brown's work, that it was not an article of faith required of Templars to believe that that there were children from Jesus and Mary Magdalene. There were some who believed that. There were others who didn't. There's different ways of looking at the Merovingian dynasty and whether they were in fact descended from that lineage or whether it was just a really good thing to claim that they were in a kind of, you know, behind the scenes, which is in history, if you look at a lot of royal dynasties claim descent from a god. It's always a good thing to claim descent from a god. I mean, the Japanese emperor, even as late as World War II, most of the Japanese people believed that he was descended from the sun god. So it's something that, you know, you see in history a lot where a royal lineage will try to substantiate its claim to power by claiming descent from divinity. My own take on that, because I follow a path of meditation and the control of the life force, which, you know, celibacy doesn't work very well, as we're seeing in the Catholic Church. If you are not working with the life force in the spine, if you are not channeling and transmuting that energy. And so for a divine incarnation, such as Jesus, that the likelihood that he was, in fact, channeling the divine energy, you know, there's many places in the gospel that talk about it. You know, there's the mysterious passage, the light of the body is the eye. If therefore thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light. Well, that's a reference to the third eye, to the spiritual eye, the light of the spiritual eye seen, the single eye seen in meditation. And so personally, my take on it is that there may very well have been a divine union with the Magdalene as his closest disciple and feminine counterpart that took place after the resurrection, that this divine lineage was intended to be carried on in France. I don't know that for a fact. That just resonates for me. There are those who believe that John Martinus was the son of the Magdalene from that union, and that he was the first Templar, that he was born on the Isle of Iona off of Scotland, which is well known as a place of great sanctity, and that that is the source from whom the Templars that's the Templar lineage. The Cathars actually did not emerge until some centuries later. They called themselves the true Christians. They traced their story back to the Magdalene. So that's certainly accurate. And, you know, they did not have centralized authority. They rejected the authority of the Pope. They had, you know, equality between men and women. They believed in reincarnation. It was essentially many of the same beliefs that we call New Age today, for which the Cathars were persecuted and ultimately massacred by the Roman Catholic Church. It was the first genocide in Europe was committed by the Roman Catholic Church against the Cathars. And it kind of started the clock ticking for the Templars. There were several Templar Grand Masters who actually were Cathars. And it was a beautiful culture of tolerance and music and poetry. And it's just one of the great unspeakable tragedies of European history. But it is this through line to what we're dealing with today. It is this through line of control, of greed, of domination, of globalism seeking to eradicate national sovereignty, and also the sovereignty of the soul in direct relation to the divine, the direct unmediated relationship between the soul and God. That is what Joan of Arc was an example of. She was a good Catholic, a dutiful Catholic, and her authority came from direct communion. Now, they tested her, because anybody can say, hey, I've had voices and visions and, you know, give me an army, I'm going to go save the world. Well, it was her charisma, her sanctity, her purity that carried the day. And this was for nationalism. This was for French culture, for the French-speaking people, for the land of France as given to them by God. Now, okay, you go back through history.
Can I interrupt you here? How did she end up getting burned at the stake?
Okay,
because
I'm
assuming that they won the war, essentially.
Yeah, they won the war. She after she lifted the siege of Orléans, there was the famous battle at Poitiers, and the English power was basically crippled after that battle, and sort of they managed to keep a power base at Calais on the coast. But then there was the siege of Paris. Her primary goal, she said from the beginning, is to crown the Dauphin King of France in the cathedral at Reims. That would make him the true king in the eyes of the people of France. Now, the power players in England didn't get it. They didn't realize what a huge symbolic and powerful move this was. When she managed to coax the Dauphin out of his little corner, say, yes, Your Grace, you must go to your cathedral and be crowned king. And when he was, that was the supreme move that her whole life, her short, fantastic life was about. A short time after that, she was captured by the English outside, you know, in a part of the campaign around Paris. And so they set up, you know, a kangaroo court, because they were the whole thing was predetermined. They were going to burn her at the stake as a witch. And the thing to remember about Joan of Arc, okay, that was in, you know, the 1429, I think, was when she died. That's a long time ago. But these aren't legends. Joan of Arc, her history, is the most well-documented story, biography of anyone who lived even before the year 1600, because the whole history comes down to us under oath. The records of her trial are preserved in the archives of France. 25 years after her death, King Charles, who was the Dauphin, did what was called the rehabilitation, and everybody who knew Joan, who is still alive from childhood, came in under oath. All the words that we are told she said come to us under oath, all the incidents of her life. It's incredibly well documented. It's one of the reasons her story is so powerful. It's the facts are highly detailed about who she was, what she said, what she did, the prophecies she made, how they came true. And so essentially, that's what happened. The English, you know, they set up, they had some French puppets of their own. French Bishop Cochon, who presided at her trial, and she was burned at the stake. Her heart, by the way, would not burn. And so they threw her heart into the river so that it would not be collected by the people and become a holy relic. And so what basically happened 25 years later, King Charles, you know, realizes, gosh, I was crowned by a woman who was burned at the stake as a witch. We got to clean this up. So this is what the rehabilitation and all these people who were called in to testify, and ultimately her character emerged stainless and pure. Never mind Shakespeare, because of course he was writing the English version, and in the history plays she's portrayed as a witch. But that's what happened. And whenever I read the biography, there's a wonderful biography of Joan by Mark Twain. Most people don't realize Mark Twain devoted 12 years of his life to writing a biography of Joan. And I read it when I was 8 years old. I could never bring myself to come to the end. Anyway, does that answer your question?
Absolutely. Thank you. I'm sorry I interrupted you, but all of a sudden, well, you know, I think that I don't, well, me, my generation, we were introduced to Joan of Arc through the movie with, what was that actress?
Ingrid Bergman?
Yes. And as I must have been, I don't know, 13 or something, and I can remember the end of that movie just sobbing and sobbing, you know. And I suddenly realized that I probably wasn't following the movie very well, because I really didn't. When you said that the English were the ones that tried her, but the French were overseeing it. Is that correct?
Yeah. Basically, there were the English had been occupying that part of France for a long time. And so essentially, these were French puppets. The whole Burgundian party, the Duke of Burgundy had allied himself with the English and betrayed France, and there was the Armagnacs versus the Burgundians, and it's a, you know, long, complicated history of France to get into, but they retained Calais. The English held on to Calais, you know, for another 100 years or so before they were finally kicked out of France.
Okay, now, in the promo, that facade that the two statues that we're talking about are in, where is that located? Did it survive?
Well, this is interesting. It looks like it probably did. The image of St. Mary Magdalene on the facade, I believe it's in the front, towards the front of the cathedral. The statue of Joan of Arc that you see is inside the cathedral, so I don't know if it was destroyed or not. Interesting thing about that statue, talking about the archives of France and how the story of Joan was preserved, that statue with the Magdalene money pouch and the Templar sword which can be interpreted as linking Joan to a Templar stream still running in France. That statue was very likely not even placed in the cathedral until the 20th century, because you can only put a statue of someone inside a Catholic church if they're a saint. Joan was not canonized a saint until like 1920, 25, somewhere in there. And this is when the records of her trial were discovered in the archives of France some years before. And this is when George Bernard Shaw wrote his play, Saint Joan. And there was this sudden great enthusiasm for Joan that came out when the archives were first brought out. I think it was in the late 1800s. And that's when Mark Twain wrote his book. So what that means is that after she was canonized a saint, which means a statue can be placed inside a church of her, we're in the 20th century. So that means that if those are Templar symbols, they were placed on that statue, and that statue was placed inside Notre Dame, the primary symbol of the French nation, by surviving Templars. At least that is a persuasive interpretation that you could take, because those are some major indications.
So that particular statue is from the beginning of the 19th century?
I'm sorry, 20th century. Yeah, I mean, that I don't know that for an absolute fact. I tried to find out when the statue was placed there. But because you have to be a saint to have a statue inside a Catholic church, and she was not a saint until 1920, and because, you know, it definitely does not date from the 15th century, from the time when she lived. I believe it must be a 20th century statue, but I don't have the actual records of that. But it seems extremely likely. And I hope it survived. I don't know. You know, we'll see.
Now, when... okay, so when, by the time that Joan was killed, Notre Dame was up and running and had been for quite a while.
Yes, that's right. As I mentioned, King Henry VI of England, the son of Henry V, who defeated the French at Agincourt, he was crowned King of France inside Notre Dame. Sometime in the early 1400s.
And was it being run as a Catholic church?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was begun in the year 1160. So that's the 12th century. It was finished in the mid-13th century. The Templars were suppressed at the beginning of the 14th century, the year 1307. And so, it was a consecrated Catholic church all that time, up until the French Revolution, when it was desecrated.
And then what happened?
Well, they almost decided to tear it down. And then Napoleon decided that he wanted it cleaned up because he wanted to be crowned emperor inside Notre Dame, which is, you know, where the French kings had been crowned, and to add perceived legitimacy. And this was, you know, a time when anti-clericalism was rampant in France after the revolution, because, you know, what happened was that the church allied itself with the regime over the centuries and ended up oppressing the people, you know, people like Cardinal Richelieu and all the forces that led to the revolution. You know, whereas Joan was beloved and is still beloved in France, as the savior of France, she loved and saved the heart of France. She was burned by the church, okay, who later canonized her. She was burned by French clerics who were obedient to English domination. But ultimately, the people, you know, there was the devoted Catholics. But then there was this huge resentment against the way that the hierarchy of the church had allied themselves with the regime against the people. And so, you know, in the early years of 1800s, for a long time, there was, the government was, you know, the revolutionary government was anti-Catholic, anti-clerical. And so the cathedral was not, you know, it was not used for mass. It was desecrated. It was nearly in ruins. And so over the course of the 1800s and 1900s, various restoration efforts were undertaken. The stained glass was removed from the cathedral during World War II, especially as the Germans were being driven out. You may remember the movie Is Paris Burning, where the word was that Hitler wanted to burn Paris to the ground if he was driven out. And so the stained glass in the cathedral was removed by the French to preserve it and was later reinstalled after the war.
Now, is there indications that any of that stained glass survived?
The damage is so bad. I haven't seen the details. I really haven't had the heart to look at the pictures. There is, I mean, so much was lost that can never be replaced. I don't know. I hope that there is a lot of it that can be. It's such a loss. It's such an irreplaceable loss.
You know, that statue of Mary, I won't specify which one, holding Jesus, that it was like at the altar area, and then a big cross behind it, those survived. They look like they're unmarked.
Okay, well, that's wonderful to hear. That's a Pietà, Pietà. You know, we refer to the Pietà,
right,
which is in Rome. But that's certainly wonderful news to hear. And I, President, or is it Prime Minister? I get it mixed up. Macron of France, came out yesterday, I heard, saying, you know, we'll restore Notre Dame within 5 years. That would be wonderful. I have something to share from our good friend, Reverend Maya, Kira Nartumid, who is a dame of the Johannine Templar Order. She is the prioress of the Johannine Templar Priory of the White Stone, which is located in Crestone, Colorado. And what she received intuitively in the wake of this was that the soul of Gaia, the soul of the planet, that this was her crown of stars, that Notre Dame, where Chartres Cathedral, the glorious cathedral at Chartres, may be said to be her grounding, her feet, that Notre Dame was her crown of stars, and that this was a visible manifestation of the divine feminine on the surface of the planet. And that to some extent, the spirit of Gaia has been driven into the heart of the planet and away from the surface by how badly we have contaminated the planet and how prevalent the domination of the dark faction has been. But that it was what Maya received was that her spirit left the cathedral on Monday, and that rather than representing a victory for the dark faction, that once again it backfired, and that her spirit will now take up residence in other holy places, other emerging holy places that won't necessarily be about, you know, a vast, glorious edifice. There may be humbler sacred temples that emerge, but it's about the bloodstream, the sacred bloodstream of Gaia herself in the grids of energy and light that, you know, transverse the planet. that is where the tide is turning. And one view of this may be that if this was indeed deliberate, if this did represent an attack, as you say, by that there are dark factions that try to use these energies, that it's backfired, and that this is a turning point moment where she is coming back to inhabit the entire surface of the planet, and that we, her children, have to do our part. You know, we are standing on her ground and need to be rededicated to her. And I think that's what's going to happen, that, you know, the burning of Notre Dame will light a holy flame, not a destructive one. It can light that flame in our hearts if we let it. That's what I believe is happening.
Well, I don't feel it's a bad thing. You know, the details of it are like, who knows? Everybody's going to have a different interpretation, maybe. But I think it's another indicator of this. When you start seeing images of like a building that's been there forever and ever, you know, you feel like forever and ever, so quickly go up in flames. You know, it's one of those instability things. We've got a lot of instability thoughts and concepts that seem to be emerging, you know, one after the other. I don't even know where this comes from. You probably do, but very, very, very often I get this saying that goes through my head. This is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper. And it seems like, you know, as we go deeper and deeper into 2019 even, the things that we're seeing are like, whoa, you know, and the amount of energy that, well, even the planet itself with the Schumann changes in the frequency of the Schumann resonance, you know, there are so many things that are happening and kind of mind spinning that we just have to hold on, I think, and do what we can where we can, which in this case is 5G.
Well, exactly. And this is, you know, I mean, to bring it back around to 5G, because this is Radio 5G, where we are sharing the reality and how to roll it back. You know, this, you talk about the Schumann resonance. There's a piece in the news today about, oh, let's see, magnetic north isn't just creeping southward, it's galloping southward. You know, the magnetic protection of the planet, which shields us from the solar rays, is rapidly eroding. And that, you know, if that goes, we're toast. Well, it could lead to a polar shift, a flip. We would be, you know, I mean, the satellite network, communications network would be much more vulnerable to sun flares than we currently are. And so, yeah, there's this, you know, apocalyptic stuff. I mean, the burning of Notre Dame is an apocalyptic event. Maybe not everybody knows that it is, but, you know, symbolically, energetically, historically, spiritually, it's a fairly apocalyptic event, at least in my view. And, you know, when I look at what is attempting to be put in place with 5G, I mean, this is an attempt, 20,000 low orbit satellites blanketing the entire planet in what is a weapon system, you know. I mean, this isn't a final attempt by the dark faction to lock down human freedom. And so, yeah, it's, I don't know about a bang and a whimper, Nancy. I kind of feel like it's feeling like a bang to me right now, but it's certainly not going to be the end. I don't believe that. I don't think you do either, right?
Oh, I think we're at the end times. I think it's a battle between good and evil. If we don't stop 5G, that's the final battle, 5G. I know I sound like this, you know, this what, Chicken Little, you know, but it is.
Let's talk about it. Yeah, I mean, let's talk about at least some good news, right, to give some hope out there, because that's a big part of what we're here to do. Yeah, we're alarming people about the reality, waking people up, but also we're sharing, you know, good, solid information. 5G-KNOW.com, 5G-KNOW.com is our website. We share a lot of other great groups and networks out there that are doing work. So there's this article that came out from
Before we get to the article, because the article actually goes into what I want to present, there was a woman, and you can see it and give the information, who was from the Vienna UN office, who was before the UN Assembly, explaining to the the head of the UN, the
Secretary General
of the UN, explaining how they had been under 5G since 2015. And it's only 4 minutes, and I want to play it, because she put it in a nutshell exactly, you know, what the problem is. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to play that.
That'd be great.
Mr. Secretary General, UN staff have repeatedly been told that they are the most important resource of this organization. Since December 2015, the staff here at the Vienna International Center have been exposed to off-the-scale electromagnetic radiation from Wi-Fi and mobile phone boosters installed on very low ceilings throughout the buildings. Current public exposure levels are at least 1 quintillion, that's 18 zeros, 1 quintillion times above natural background radiation, according to Professor Ole Johansson of the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. The highly dangerous biological effects of EMFs have been documented by thousands of studies since 1932, indicating that we may be facing a global health catastrophe orders of magnitude worse than those caused by tobacco and cigarettes. Mr. Secretary General, on the basis of the precautionary principle, I urge you to have these EMF-emitting devices removed immediately from these buildings and to call a halt to any rollout of 5G at UN duty stations, because 5G is designed to deliver concentrated and focused electromagnetic radiation in excess of 100 times current levels, in the same way as do directed energy weapons. In line with the UN guiding principles on business and human rights, to protect, respect, and remedy, 5G technologies must be subjected to an independent health and safety assessment before they are launched anywhere in the world. There is currently an international appeal signed by 237 EMF scientists from 41 nations urging the UN and particularly the WHO to exert strong leadership in fostering the development of more protective EMF guidelines, encouraging precautionary measures, and educating the public about the considerable health risks, particularly the risks to children and fetal development. Mr. Secretary General, I think we have a unique opportunity here at the UN office at Vienna. Since our medical records are digitized, you have the choice and the possibility of releasing data on a closed population exposed to off-the-scale levels of electromagnetic radiation in a metal-walled building, which exacerbates the situation, to establish if there have already been abnormal health consequences for the UN staff here in the last 28 months. I urge you to do so and stop any rollout of 5G immediately. Thank you.
Sorry, because we are talking with someone that is a little bit ignorant on these things. We're talking to the Wi-Fi systems?
On the ceilings of these buildings, Wi-Fi boosters and cell phone boosters were installed without consultation, without information to staff, in December 2015. The situation here is extremely dangerous. I have heard anecdotally of many people who have had health problems. I don't know if they are related, but the precautionary principle would dictate that we use our medical records to look into this and that we remove these dangerous devices immediately. Thank you.
Well, I become worried because I put those devices in my house.
Not a good idea.
I confess my ignorance on this. I'm going to raise this with WHO, which I think is the organization that might be able to deal with it properly, for them to, put someone, their staff or organizations to work on that, because I must confess I was not aware of that danger.
So there you have it. I thought that was just, in a nutshell, only one little snapshot of one little problem. And the response of the Secretary General was just so perfect. I'm ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
It's all awareness. Because one of the things they say in this article, or one of these articles, is that when people become aware of what the situation is, they run from it.
Yeah, who wouldn't, you know? That was Claire Edwards, by the way. And, you know, the longtime UN staff member in Vienna. And this article that we want to take some time to look at from takebackyourpower.net, which is a great organization to go to for ways to do just that, take back our power and stop these deadly rollouts. So Nancy, I'd like to just, you know, go through this article and share some of the good news that's going on. Shall we do that?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, takebackyourpower.net. It's called 5G. The dominoes are starting to fall. Longtime UN staff member Claire Edwards summarizes worldwide developments in the 5G situation. While still far from a victory claim, and we really want to emphasize that, there is much to be hopeful about as millions around the world deepen involvement and take a stand for our shared future. So how do you stop the rollout of a $12 trillion technology promoted by one of the most profitable industries on the planet and bulldozed through by the EU, FCC, and the whole UN, and most notably its Wi-Fi enablers, the World Health Organization, and the ITU. Many people have said it's impossible, but even as the Trump administration attempts to ram through 5G in the United States, the dominoes are indeed falling around the world as cities and entire nations are coming to their senses and putting the brakes on 5G. And then they give another excellent link, whatis5g.info. Okay, so here we go. Here's the good news, folks. Lawmakers hitting the brakes on 5G. On March 24th, just a few weeks ago, Portland, Oregon, city officials state clear opposition to the installation of 5G networks around the city, supported by the mayor and two commissioners. In Italy, on March 28th of this year, the city of Florence applies the precautionary principle, and I think you heard Claire Edwards citing that principle in her conversation just now with the UN Secretary General, applies the precautionary principle, refusing permissions for 5G and referring to the, quote, ambiguity and uncertainty of supranational bodies and private bodies like the ICNIRP, whatever that is, which have very different positions from each other despite the huge evidence of published studies. And again, there is no doubt on this. You can't paint this like the tobacco industries did. Oh, maybe cigarettes cause lung cancer. He's like, no, there are thousands of studies, and the levels of 5G they're putting in are hundreds and hundreds of times above the safety level. Okay, Italy, March 28th, Rome. One Roman district votes against 5G trials, with others expected to follow. Other motions to stop 5G are expected in the four regional councils, one provincial council, and other municipal councils of Italy. Russia, March 28th. The Russian Ministry of Defense refuses to transfer frequencies for 5G, which effectively delays any 5G rollout in Russia for several years. Well, good for the Russians. Belgium, March 31st, the Belgian Environment Minister announces that Brussels, the city of Brussels, is halting its 5G rollout plans. And the Environment Minister stated, quote, the people of Brussels are not guinea pigs whose health I can sell at a profit. That guy should be given a knighthood. Germany, April 4th, Germans signed a petition en masse to force the German Bundestag to debate 5G. In the Netherlands, on April 4th, members of parliament in the Netherlands insist that radiation research must be carried out before any approval of the 5G network. And, you know, trying to think about how anybody would carry out radiation research on 5G and then say, oh, it's okay, we'll just go ahead and put in this energy weapon system and fry our brains, cripple our children, etc.
Well, let's just stop there for a second, because in front of a Senate committee, the heads of AT&T, Verizon, and Sprint all said that they had not done and spent 1 cent in researching the possible health damages. Now, we know this is BS. They damn well know it's damaging, but they actually can't provide any kind of data that says it is healthy. And that's what I think that they're responding to. Nobody's ever done, you know.
Yeah, and what most folks are responding to, you know, it's the big propaganda campaign. There isn't the slightest hint of a risk in this big, you know, oh, the happy 5G world, the Internet of Things. You can download 12 movies while you're waiting at the airport gate. You know, there's not the slightest hint of there being a health risk. And I imagine that most of the people who are being trotted out there to spin this stuff, they've been fed a line of BS, which it's in their interest to simply accept. Like, there's that quote from, I think it was Upton Sinclair. Al Gore probably used it, I think. It's very difficult to convince somebody of something if their livelihood depends on their not being convinced of it. You know, so that's what we're dealing with. But people are stepping up and having a conscience. Switzerland on April 9th. California, April 5th. California Supreme Court justices unanimously uphold a 2011 San Francisco ordinance requiring telecommunications companies to get permits before placing antennas on city infrastructure. Now, just to touch on this, in the U.S., back in, I think it was 96, under Bill Clinton, a law was passed which pretty much superseded and removed the ability of states and municipalities to oppose the FCC in the installation of these networks. Now, that is a violation of the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. It, you know, violates all kinds of things, right, to left and center. And there is major pushback going on around it, even to the point of sovereignty movements working with the work of Judge Anna von Reitz in going to county registrars, creating councils that are working with the sovereignty of the county, you know, the local authority, working with local authorities, local sheriffs. There's a lot of hope there as well. TakeBackYourPower.net also offers the notice of liability tool, very powerful tool to use, which basically you give this notice of liability to legislators, town councilors, city council members saying, guess what? You are personally liable for the damage, deaths, disease that have been demonstrated to take place. If these take place because you approved the rollout of 5G in my neighborhood, you will be personally liable. You could lose your home. You could go to jail. So it's not like, you know, we are coming torches and pitchforks. We're just letting these people know that this is not just some propaganda rollout. Say yes because they made a nice contribution to your campaign. You could lose your home if you go along with this.
An excuse to do the right thing.
Yeah, there you go. Perfect. Remember, help me remember that. An excuse to do the right thing. That's a good line. Last couple of instances here. In Switzerland, the canton of Vaud, V-U-A-D, adopts a resolution on April 9th of this month calling for a moratorium on 5G antennas until the publication this summer of a report on 5G by the Swiss Federal Office for the Environment. The next day, the 10th of April, Geneva, the city of Geneva, also adopted a moratorium on 5G, calling on the Council of State to request the World Health Organization to monitor independent scientific studies. Now, you know, the World Health Organization, once you get into, you know, the UN structure, this is, we're seeing this divide now. We're seeing this conflict. This is one of the things Sacha Stone, whose wonderful documentary 5G Apocalypse we discussed on Project Camelot last week with Kerry Cassidy, he pointed out, you know, there is a split. Europe is tilting eastward. They are tilting away from the American Anglo cabal and more towards a Eurocentric orientation. And this could be why they're beginning to oppose 5G. Russia won't have it. Brussels won't have it. The EU is moving away from it. That's a really helpful thing.
They also don't put fluoride in their water.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we don't want to retard our children's mental development. It's all for cavities, kids, not to worry, right? So I wanted to ask you, Nancy, what do you make of the Trump administration's policy on this? I mean, it's pretty difficult to maintain the theory that Trump is just doing, reverse psychology, so aggressively coming out, attempting to ram 5G, right past any municipal authority to stop it. I mean, how do we reconcile this with, what some people would like to believe about Trump as an anti-globalist or as a champion of states' rights and who supposedly is anti-5G behind the scenes? What do you think?
Personally, I would prefer to see the president in the role that he's playing now, whether he believes it or not. Because if he had come out and said, I'm going to stop 5G, well, the movement of the expansion of the human family would have stopped. Oh, daddy's got it taken care of. Let's go back to the sand pit. Okay?
Yeah.
So, to me, this is a good thing. For just practical purposes, I don't want you to think that this is the only problem. There's many, many more. But we can fix them all. We just have to be aware of them all. So that's where I come from there. But the other side of it is I really don't care what the federal government does. This is no longer something that is the concept of the federal government can tell us what to do. By the Constitution, they cannot tell us what to do. And we have given over this power to them. And it has to start in the states. It has to start in the cities. It has to start at the local level where people say, no, I'm going to take back my power. Thank you very much for holding it on and screwing it up so bad, but you really are fired. Okay? Mm-hmm. So let's just not even worry what the federal government is doing, because the federal government has got the FCC that told everybody, you're going to have these death traps in your yard. And not only that, but we're going to make you pay for them. Because mm-hmm. there was then a law that came out and said that the local governments are only going to get a fraction of what it costs to put these things out there and to maintain them. And the rest of they're not only got a system to control and kill us, they're making us pay for it as citizens, as taxpayers. And this is where the real balking is coming from the cities initially, was we can't afford this. You talk about taking one move too much. You know, this is like, why didn't you just pay for it? You know, because this is where the first blowback came when they were saying 200 cities are disputing this. And I'm thinking, oh, great. Well, then I find out, no, they're disputing it because they don't want to pay for it. They're not disputing it because they think it's dangerous. But any reason to stop it, at this point in the game.
Yeah, and I hear you about the story, too. You know, if Trump came out against it and said, oh, we're stopping it, the energy and fire would go out of the movement, and it would probably be wrong. It would probably be not true. You know, I don't think he actually has the capability to oppose the telecom industries and the forces behind them, because this goes way up the chain, way above his head in terms of, the puppeteers behind the scenes globally. So, yeah, I mean, that, and we are putting them on notice that we're taking back our power. And we are many and they are few. And if every county in the United States, one county at a time, takes back our power, our legitimate constitutional power, not constitutionally granted as sovereign beings. And, you know, completely legally and, you know, locally. And this isn't about picking a fight with the IRS or doing a Ruby Ridge or a Waco. This is about going down and talking to your county registrar, letting the sheriff know, hey, you know, this is a very damaging technology and there's certain county powers that we have. This is about, you know, a grassroots, peaceful, but unequivocal, forceful, we'll say, peacefully forceful way of taking back our power and saying no. And as you say, Nancy, it's just the first fight of many, but it's the big one. This is the one that if we let it roll out, we're done. The biosphere is done, the bees are done, and very shortly we are done. And in the meantime, you know, you've got neurological impairment, tumors, cancer, DNA breakdown. It's difficult to get to be people to really believe and accept the overwhelming scientific evidence about what this is doing. But it's the truth, folks, and time is running out, and we must do it now.
I had this young man who was, you know, saying to me, but surely you can make a device that will protect us against 5G. And I said, even if I had it, I wouldn't even offer it. And he said, oh, come on, you know, I mean, maybe they'll get it out there. Maybe we need this. I said, look it. I said, if I had the device and you had it, maybe you and your family would survive, but you would survive in a dead world. What's the point?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, while we know, for example, that Shungite provides protection against EMF and 4G. And some people are saying, oh, well, you know, I've got Shungite. Well, no, you know, and you and I, of course, are ardent Shungite missionaries. But no, folks, don't think for a minute that your Shungite necklace is going to protect you from this, you know, microwave weapon technology.
Not at all. Not at all.
No.
Now, we've still got 6 minutes, so let's just, if you've got it up, the cities fight back, that one, that goes in and talks about the cities.
Okay, I want to be sure I'm on the same page with you. The cities fighting back, okay, because we have Sebastopol, California, we got Mill Valley, there's like 80 cities around the country who already have instigated actions to stop 5G. Obviously, it needs to be hundreds, thousands more, but it's really encouraging. Are you looking at that link, Nancy? Because I'm not.
Well, yeah, I've got it. I've actually got it as a PDF. So it's okay. It's one of. Am I looking at the right one? Okay, well, it's in front of me, so let me just quickly read it so that we can get a feeling from it. From coast to coast, local governments are taking action to protect their communities from the unfettered development of 4G and 5G small cell wireless facilities. Several cities are passing ordinances that strictly limit the build-out. Many policymakers are asking, what are other cities doing? So this page is a compilation of what's been going on in different different places. And let's see, what is this one? I think that this is, okay, examples of ordinances that address, that are addressed, okay, is prohibiting small cell installations in residential areas and certain streets. So they can actually, you know, stop it going into residential areas, all right? Requiring installations to be a certain distance away. Well, I've seen the figures, and it's crazy. I mean, you're not anywhere near away from it. Specific that installations must be relocated if and when they would interfere with public project, aesthetics and environment. Okay, so they say aesthetics and environment, but their only thing doing is noise and camouflaging and height. You know, it's not talking about the environment. And why is the environment so critical? Because the structure of the insects actually makes them more vulnerable to these millimeter signals. You've got administrative legal requiring residents. You know, I mean, it's all this tedious kind of BS stuff that's not getting to the real heart of it, but at least it's slowing them down. And you got Petaluma.
Sounds like Petaluma.
Yeah, California.
Bay Area.
Yeah, they're doing it with protecting environmental resources and protecting residents against adverse health effects. So they're starting to get on board with it. Fairfax, California, you know, prohibiting them on the things I talked about it before that, but also demanding that there be a look at the citywide fiber optic cable network instead of this. Because some of the key things is that if the telecommunications companies can't prove that there is a weakness in the existing system so that they're going to, you know, upgrade but fix that, then they can't even go into a lot of these places. And that's another thing they're looking at, because the idea is that, well, we don't want you coming in every 5 years and putting more up and charging everybody more. So if you don't have a weakness in the system, then don't come asking to build more. That's where that's coming in. Warren, Connecticut, this is exactly what they're talking about, the adequate field area. Burlington, Massachusetts, okay, they're doing what they've done in there is that they've actually drafted policies where you have to have an annual recertification fee against the telecommunications companies. And this was a town that actually Verizon withdrew its application because every single year they were going to have to come back, pay more fees, and for every one of these antennas, they were going to have to get it recertified. Again, got too expensive. So there are many, many, many different ways that these stoppages are happening. And all you need to know is as much as you can about 5G. But focus on what you can do, not you know, the awfulness. Focus on what you can do.
Yeah, exactly. The awfulness is well established, and the tools that we can use are in our hands. And takebackyourpower.net is one of the best organizations out there. The notice of liability tool to state legislators and municipalities is very effective. And for us here at Radio 5G, we are live on the air at 12 noon Eastern every Wednesday. That is then rebroadcast on Cosmic Reality Radio and will be available on YouTube. And we can win, Spirit will win, as 5G can and will be stopped, but it is a race against time. So we need to do everything we can. You know, you don't need to go down the rabbit hole that we all took you down today. It's basic, folks. It's about the health of your children. It's about the value of your home. It's about the survival of the biosphere. And so we thank you for tuning in with us today, for speaking on behalf of the Sacred Academy of Geoenergetics in Crestone, Colorado, and for Nancy with Cosmic Reality. Nancy, did you want to give a last hail and farewell message?
Just that we also have archives, and some of the archives are shows that weren't initially Radio 5G shows, so there's even more information on that page.
Right. Okay. And this show, this program today will be available on YouTube shortly and also rebroadcast on Cosmic Reality. So thank you, everybody, for joining us today. God bless us all. Bye for now.
Thank you for listening. May it be.
Let it be.